A retired professor shares what he has learned about living close to the land on a rural Maine farm. Many people dream of buying an old Maine farm, growing their own crops, enjoying the wildlife, and living in concert with the rhythm of the seasons. Maybe you are one of those people. A retired Massachusetts professor, John Toomey, has not only done this, but also has written a book about what he's learned living and working his farm in Montville, Maine. The title, Retiring To, Not From. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Toomey joins us to share some practical tips and also what it's like to live this lifestyle. His goal is to live deliberately and in harmony with nature. From mulching to raising chickens to creating wildlife habitat, Toomey has carefully observed what works and what doesn't. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Many people dream of leaving the rat race for a simpler life, working the land, surrounded by nature. My guest today is living that dream. Professor John Toomey spent 37 years in the academic world, teaching and later heading up his department. When he retired, he left his work life behind to pursue his longtime goal of living self-sufficiently on a remote farm. He joins me in the studio to talk about his experiences. John Toomey is a former professor and chair of the Department of Foreign Literature and Languages at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He now lives full-time on his farm in Montville, Maine. He's written a book about his farm experiences. Its title is Retiring To, Not From, Intimate Details of Life on a Remote Farm in Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you always shared that dream? Do you have questions about growing your own food or living off the grid? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Professor Toomey, thanks for making the drive during planting season to be here.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Jennifer.
Your dream of living on a Maine farm goes way back, doesn't it? This was not a midlife crisis decision.
No, not at all. In fact, I started out life in a very rural setting in western Massachusetts. And I'm from a family of relatively few resources, so we children played a great deal out of doors, spent a lot of times in the woods and in the streams and such of the hills of that area. And so for my entire young life and midlife, I longed to return to that paradise, if you will, that I enjoyed as a child. In addition to that, as I was growing up, mainly as a teenager, I saw a good deal of development of farmland in that area. And the farm, in fact, across the road from where I was a child, has been turned into a subdivision. Likewise, my second home was on a small farm in western Mass, and the farm across from that house has likewise been developed. And I knew both those farmers well, and I knew of their love of their land, and I so enjoyed seeing the rural setting there, and it was a great loss for me to see those changed. So that instilled in me, I think, it's safe to say, a desire to own and protect a traditional New England farm. And fortunately, I've had a career that allowed me to do that. And in 1978, I bought the place up in Montville, Maine, and am living that childhood dream all over again.
How did you choose Montville, Maine?
Well, I honestly looked in Vermont, New Hampshire, Quebec, Nova Scotia, and far western Mass. And I looked at a number of places. But in all honesty, when I drove down that mile-and-a-half-long dirt road to the dead end, where the Howard place is located, and drove into the farmyard, I knew, in fact, that that was the place. The lay of the land was heartwarming to me. It was similar to the lay of the land where I grew up as a child. And the old buildings were, while in rough shape, they were solid. And they were a traditional Maine farmhouse and attached barn, the sort of setup that I always longed to have. And it was, in effect, as they say, love at first sight.
Your book is written as a resource for the next generation, but I want to go into some details later. But you're busy on a farm. What made you decide to take the time to write a book?
Well, mainly my children and grandchildren have a strong interest in what goes on the farm. They're not able to be there as often as they'd like because they live busy lives and they don't live nearby. But they're always interested in the food that's grown, the processes for raising brook trout, raising chickens, cutting firewood, maintaining the fields, maintaining the brushy patches for wildlife, the development of wildlife habitat. So I decided it would be a wise idea, since I tragically am not going to live forever, I thought it would be a wise idea to put it all down so that they could consult it as time went on, and really sort of as a part of family history, if you will.
One of the things you write about in the book is keeping a journal and how important that is. Did you depend on your journals when you turned around to write the book?
To a degree, I did. And I just sat down in, I think, the end of December and January and February a couple of years back, and began to put notes down. But yes, I did consult my calendars. I keep a daily calendar, and Lee keeps a detailed journal.
Lee's your partner?
Yes, she is. And so I went over all of that, and it wasn't hard to do, in all honesty, because I just know the whole thing so darn well.
I thought of Thomas Jefferson when I read that you keep a daily calendar and a journal. He so depended on his.
Yeah. It's fascinating to go back in the spring. We're doing that right now, looking at the time that the first ajuga blossoms, the first dandelion blossoms, when the asparagus come up, when the fiddleheads come up, when the milkweed come up, and so on and so forth. So it's fascinating to see, and also the arrival of the birds, the tree swallows, the barn swallows, the rose-breasted grosbeaks, and so on. It's fascinating to see from year to year how close they are in terms of the date by which those things happen. So the journal is quite handy, and also planting, of course. We're meticulous at our records on planting, and so we need that to know when to plant the seeds inside and when to put the seeds out, and so on and so forth. Just 2 or 3 days ago, we were planting potatoes and peas, and it started to snow, which is not uncommon at this time of year in Maine. And my relatives from the south will sometimes say, "My God, how do you grow anything up there in Maine?" But in fact, if you just pay attention to details, it's one of the best places on earth, I think, to grow things.
You are living a dream. When you retired and you first came to the farm, was it harder than you expected it would be?
Actually, no. I had gone there in the summers every year while I was teaching, and in the fall, on weekends throughout the fall and winter. And so it was not a dramatic shift for me. In addition to that, having that early childhood in a fairly isolated setting, I think was darn good training for the relatively isolated life that we enjoy there at the farm. We know that a certain type of wiring occurs in the brain, and I think my brain was wired early on to enjoy a quiet and peaceful and isolated setting.
Professor Toomey, I know you travel the state giving talks on what you've done and helping others who maybe have the same dream. What are the common questions that you get about your farm and your lifestyle?
Well, people like to know about the solar energy, how that works. They like to know about the carbon footprint. They're interested in what we grow and how much of it, and when how we do that whole thing. They're interested in preservation of food, and they're also interested in the wildlife, especially. The wildlife, of course, are near and dear to my and Lee's hearts. As I said early on, my childhood was spent in a fairly isolated setting, and wildlife for me was an integral part of my daily life there. It wasn't a particularly easy life, and so the wildlife for me was companionship and almost a form of warm communication. And so people are interested in the wildlife that we see, and they're also interested in how we improve the wildlife habitat on the farm, and we do that meticulously and on a broad scale. And I'll talk about that later on if you're interested.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that. We're speaking with Professor John Toomey. He's written a book, Retiring To, Not From, From Massachusetts Professor to Maine Farmer. We do have a quick note. For those of you who listen to Maine Public Classical, our Millbridge Mount Desert Island station, 93.7 has unfortunately been hit by lightning and will take a couple days to fully repair. In the interim, we're running on very low power, so the signal is not as strong as it normally is. Again, this affects just 93.7 FM of the main public classical network serving Down East, Mount Desert Island, and the Blue Hill areas. We hope to have it back to full power in a couple days. Some of you may be able to hear 106.1 FM out of Bangor or be able to stream Maine Public Classical at mainepublic.org. If you'd like to join the conversation we're having right now with John Toomey about living close to the land on a Maine farm, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. How do you describe your farm? Are you off the grid? Do you describe it that way?
Yes, indeed. You'd have to, because the power lines do not extend down to that area. The folks, the Howards, who lived there from the 1860s until 1969 or 70, lived entirely off the grid. So we wanted to have the modern conveniences. So I contracted with a fellow in the Blue Hill area, Penobscot Solar, a great guy named Daryl DeJoy, and he asked us what our kilowatt needs would be. So he designed a photovoltaic system that would meet those needs. So we have 24 panels and 6 300-pound batteries in the cellar. And in all honesty, we almost never think about being off the grid. We do have to pay special attention in November and December when the days are short. If we get a series of two or three cloudy, rainy days, we won't run the washing machine and we won't vacuum. So it's a matter of paying attention a little bit to the weather and to what's going on. But that's a good thing, being a little bit more cognizant of what's going on in the world around, the immediate world around one, I think is a beneficial thing to do.
And you have a well, I'm assuming, for your water?
Oh, yeah. We have the original well is in the cellar that the Howards pumped water from a hand pump in the kitchen, and I used that for years. But when the farm was in, I had the whole place redone between 2008 and 2009, and in that process of putting in new windows and insulation and so on, we had a artesian well drilled. So that's all connected to a pump in the cellar and a holding tank in the cellar. If you were in the house and going about your business, you wouldn't know you were in a place that's off-grid. Absolutely not.
Yep. And how self-sufficient are you in terms of food? How much of your own food do you grow or catch in your pond?
Yeah, well, I'd say about 95% at least. We grow all of the vegetables that we eat. We grow all of the fruits that we eat. We raise brook trout, and that's a significant percentage of our protein needs. We have a nice flock of laying hens. They provide all the eggs that we need. I'd love to talk about the breed that we raise. But
sure. Go ahead. Tell us.
Well, it's the Golden Campine, which is a wonderful bird that was developed in Belgium 2,000 years ago, and it's a very hardy bird, beautiful bird. They lay regularly. They forage avidly. They're great for they can fly, so they evade predators with ease. They're just a spectacular little bird, and they're great companions, and so they provide all our eggs. And occasionally, as we bring in new birds, we'll be hatching young this spring. In fact, so we'll have to put several of the hens in the freezer for soups and stews during the winter. And then we'll rebuild our flock with younger birds that will continue to lay well.
Mm. And give us a sense of how many vegetables you grow.
Well, it's pretty remarkable. Our garden is relatively small, but we pay strict attention to the soil. We build the soil and improve the quality of the soil constantly. That, for us, is job one. We do that in the garden, and we do that on the entire farm by not removing any organic matter from the farm. Everything that falls down stays there and begins to make new topsoil. So in any event, we grow all kinds of vegetables, but we can, in quart jars, about 486 quarts per year, and those are all in three cupboards in the cellar. That's equivalent to 1/2 ton of food. We have a 17 or 18 cubic foot freezer that's absolutely packed with frozen vegetables and fish and poultry and so on. And we also have a root cellar in which we were able to store, and we still have those. We have plenty of those left. We have an abundance of root vegetables left, 25 to 30 pounds of carrots, beets, parsnip, 25 to 30 pounds of turnip, and also, of course, 8 or 10 bushels of apples, and maybe 150 pounds of potatoes, 250 pounds of butternut squash, a good 100 pounds of onions, and at least 100 heads of garlic. Those are all stored in different places. The garlic, the onions, and the butternut are stored in a cool room upstairs because they don't want to be damp. And the root cellars, they do fine in a nice moist area. And we just have to watch the temperature in there very carefully in order that they preserve well. Now, those root vegetables will last and be completely edible in great shape until the end of June, early July, when the next crop starts to come in. And, of course, the freezer and the canned goods. And the canned goods last for several years. We could never eat all of those in 1 year. We always make more than we need in case the following year's particular item, tomatoes or whatever, doesn't do particularly well. But to this point, in all honesty, that hasn't happened.
Someone might be listening to this thinking, oh, my gosh, this seems like a lot of work.
Well, you know, I've had people say that to me, and the truth of the matter is we really don't work more than 2 or 3 hours a day. There are times of the year when we have to put in a little more time, like in the late summer and early fall when we're canning, and in the spring when we're getting everything settled in the garden, and when we're cutting firewood in November and December, that's a little more work. But really, in all honesty, we have an abundant amount of time for calling our relatives, for emailing friends, for reading books, for walking. We take walks and we ski every single day of the year to see the wildlife tracks and keep on top of all of the ongoings on the 125 acres that the farm entails. So it's a busy life, but the work per se is the physical labor is a relatively small part of it, but it's a joyful part of it. The wonder of that kind of work is that you see a tangible result at the end of each project. Now, Lee and I taught for years, and it's a wonderful thing to teach. It's a great thing, but you don't have a concrete product at the end that you can look at and say, wow, I did that. And this rural lifestyle offers that sort of satisfaction on a full-time basis. It's really a terribly satisfying life for the likes of us.
If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Finance Authority of Maine, working for Maine by helping businesses grow jobs and families reach their higher education goals. FameMaine.com.
Journalist Walt Mossberg did a crazy thing. People in his circle thought he'd been demoted. That's because one day in 1999, he went to his editor.
I said, I have this idea for a column, but I want to turn the formula on its head. I want to champion the non-techies.
I'm Robert Siegel. On the eve of retirement, a longtime tech columnist tells us how he witnessed digital technology invade our lives. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. Do you know a high school student who is passionate about writing and would like to hone his or her skills this summer? Maine Public and the Maine Writing Project are offering Raise Your Voice workshops from July 24th through August 4th in Portland, Waterville, and Orono. Each workshop is a free 2-week summer writing experience for high school students who will work with seasoned writers and teachers to develop their writing and multimedia skills. More information is at mainepublic.org. Click on Education.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, living on a remote farm connected to nature. With me in the studio, John Toomey, a retired professor from the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth, who now lives full-time on his farm in Montville. And he's written a book about his experiences. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Professor Toomey, do you think it's easier to do what you're doing here in Maine because of the resources than it might be somewhere else?
You know, in all honesty, I would say the Northeast of the United States is very supportive in this regard, particularly Vermont and Maine, and I assume New Hampshire is too. I know a bit more about Vermont, and of course I know a great deal about Maine. So yes, I would say that there's great opportunity for help. First and foremost, the rural people of Maine, the folks who've been here for a long time, are very helpful to newcomers. They're warm-hearted in general, generous folks. And the newcomers as well, the young folks who have come up to farm, are also very willing to share their experience and their insights with anyone who asks. Beyond that, Maine has a particular, right in central Maine, we have an abundance of resources. We have MOFCA, which holds the Farm and Homestead Day in June. That's coming up. In fact, Lee and I do a birdhouse building workshop at that. And of course, the Common Ground Fair in the fall. So MOFCA is a terrific resource. The University of Maine Extension also. You can call them with any rural problem, and they will get back. They'll answer the question, or they will get back to you. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that in a moment. Beyond that, we have Johnny Selected Seeds, which is the a great seed company. The folks there are very helpful. And also Fedco, the tree company, and the seed and tuber company right over in Clinton, Maine. So those folks are all very helpful. And if they don't have the answer, they know someone who does. I can give you a couple of examples. For example, I do a lot of apple grafting. I have roughly 350 wild apples on the farm, apple trees on the farm, and I've grafted heirloom varieties onto about 85 of those trees. Some of those we actually had fruit from last year, and they were absolutely spectacular. The Rhode Island Greening, an ancient apple from Middletown, Rhode Island, is what we had about six of those, and we just relished them. We almost fought over every bite on each one of those. But, for example, if I have a question on grafting, I can call MOFCA, or I can call John Bunker, or I can call C.J. Walk. These are guys who know a great deal about apples, great deal about apple grafting, and any little bump or problem that you come upon, they know how to solve it, and they are very willing to do so. As far as blueberries, I have about 8 acres of blueberries, and managing those and mowing those is a question I had, and I called Dave Yarborough up at the University of Maine. He's the blueberry expert at the University of Maine. Got right back to me with advice and suggestions. So there are abundant resources, and most importantly, those who man those resources are very kind, very generous folks.
Speaking of apples, you're doing something really neat, I read in your book, with the students at Madomic Valley High School.
Yes, that's the heirloom chicken effort there.
Oh. Chickens, not apples. Sorry.
Yeah. They are interested. They have a fabulous heirloom seed collection activity at the school. They engage the students in it and so on. So last year, they were interested in expanding their repertoire to include chickens, and so they contacted me. They knew they'd read an article about my heirloom chickens, our heirloom chickens, the golden campaigns, and they thought, well, perhaps we could raise these. So we brought them 24 eggs and. Their incubator failed. It didn't work out. So we then hatched 24 chicks for them and brought them down there. And as far as I know, they raised those. I haven't heard from them recently, but they raised those last year, and we're going to have chicks and sell chicks from those this spring.
Great. We're going to go to Lewiston and Chris. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Chris, are you there? Shoot, seems like we've missed Chris. We'll go to Eleanor calling from Camden. Hi, Eleanor. Go ahead. Eleanor, are you there? We seem to be having problems with our phone, so if you are listening and trying to call in, please hold tight, and we'll try to figure out what's going on here. Professor Toomey, I want to talk about, we've talked a lot about the farm, but just only a little about the whole idea of preserving wildlife habitat. I think a lot of people who dream of farmsteading are really focusing on sustenance.
Yes.
But that's only part of what you're doing.
Yes, indeed, it is. In all honesty, my original motivation for getting a farm like this was to work on wildlife habitat. As I said early on, wildlife was tremendously important to me as a youngster. And it remains as important. So the wildlife habitat effort that I undertake there is pretty broad. I have 40 acres in fields, and I have a rotary mower on my tractor. And so I mow those fields in a fashion that creates three distinct habitats within all of the fields all the time. And these three distinct, I'm not sure if all of the insects and birds and small mammals and amphibians that take advantage of those three habitats, but I know they're there. So that's one major component. The fields and the wildflowers, of course, a major focus for me is the native pollinators, the blue orchard bees, the mason bees, the bumblebees. So beyond that, I also create habitat in what's called brushy areas, and those are created by cutting trees and cutting the brush periodically. I have about 5 acres in heavy, heavy brush. And I could give a lecture literally on each one of these kinds of habitats. So I'll just sort of mention them without going into excessive detail. So the brushy areas are used by all sorts of smaller animals and smaller birds. I create large brush piles also from the cutting that I do of my firewood. I pile the brush up in large piles. And just yesterday I was out standing next to one of those, and I was able to see a pair of winter wrens, which are a lovely little bird, hopping in and out of that brush pile, and I'm sure they're going to nest in that area. Also, snags. Snags are trees that are dead but left standing. And sometimes I create 2 to 3 of those per acre, and those are habitat for woodpeckers, insects, and also they are nesting areas for our mason bees. They nest in the holes that the borers leave when they come out. Beyond all of that, I've planted about 3,000 white and chestnut oaks on the farm, and these are oaks that produce acorns, some of which are already producing acorns. They are adored by and sought after by all kinds of wildlife, wild turkeys, deer, a hare, of course, squirrels. Beyond that, the apple trees, I let all of the apples from the crab apples and the native apples stay on the ground or stay in the trees for the birds in the winter, for the wildlife throughout the winter. So there are a number of areas like this in which I constantly work on for habitat. And as a result, one could ask, well, do you see any result from this? And the answer is absolutely yes. There's an old saying that if you build it, they will come. And this is absolutely true with habitat. Nature abhors a vacuum. So if you create a particular habitat, animals that need that habitat will come to it. So it's not uncommon. It's extremely common for us to see on a regular basis, since we are so quiet, we see all kinds of songbirds, snowshoe hare, wild turkeys, white-tailed deer, bobcats, coyotes, red fox, occasionally gray fox, raccoons, porcupines, fishers, and of course all of the native pollinators, the bumblebees and the blue orchard bees and the mason bees. They're pretty exciting stuff, and it's so rewarding. I would say it's tremendously fulfilling, at least for the likes of me, to have worked on a particular area and then see a particular wild creature come and make use of that. And as I say, Lee and I are very quiet. We don't disturb the animals, and as a result, we get to see a terrific amount of terrific Maine wildlife.
All right. Well, we're going to try to go back to the phone. Yeah. Spencer in China, are you there?
I am.
Fantastic. Go ahead.
Well, I had a question for the professor. He's obviously a man of incredible willpower and knowledge, and I wondered why he waited till he retired to do what he wanted to do.
Well, that's a very good question. It has to do mainly with finances. I'm from a relatively humble background, and I had to work very hard to get a career that would allow me to have a good income and a good retirement. Now, I should add, the result was that I wasn't able to financially handle this earlier on, and I wanted to handle it in a convenient and effective way, which I have indeed been able to do. I should add to that throughout my teaching career, I always owned a home where I was able to have chickens. I was able to raise gardens, a significant amount of vegetables, and work a little bit on wildlife habitat. So to a degree, I was always dabbling in this even while I was a professor. And now I'm able to dabble in it a whole lot. And I stayed the full 37 years because I had a strong commitment to the university and to the students. I could have retired a few years earlier And sometimes I think, well, maybe I should have. But I had a wonderful career. I love the teaching. I had great students, dedicated, hardworking, curious students, and wonderful colleagues, with whom, many of whom I maintain contact with via email or the occasional visit. So I hope that answers your question adequately. If not, please follow up.
All right, Spencer, thanks so much for calling in. I'm going to see if I can get to, doesn't look like we can get to Chris. Chris, if you can hear this, it'd be great if you can call back. We're going to go to Bangor and Larry. Hi, Larry, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hello, Professor. I did what you did in reverse. I'm from Chicagoland, and where I grew up, there was a farm across the street, and the nearest farm now is 30 miles west.
Yep.
So I equally missed ruralness. I read Nearing, and like a lot of other people, I decided to move up here and didn't realize until much later that Nearing was living off of trust fund.
Yeah.
That's why all of us couldn't make it. But in any event, I farmed for a long time, and I taught physics, taught mathematics, and finally had to give up the farm because of, I've had 36 operations.
But okay.
I just wanted to, I'm glad to hear somebody else did it, and you're doing it at my age, and I wish I could be doing it.
Well, good for you. Thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it very much.
We'll move on. Chris calling back from Lewiston. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yay. Sorry about our technical problems.
No,
go
no
ahead.
Problem. Yes. Well, in a way, it's kind of a follow-up to a couple of previous comments. My wife and I have been, dreaming about going back to the land, similar to what Professor Toomey did. And we've read a lot of literature going back to the Nearings, living the good life. Mm-hmm. And while all of this sounds very good and very attractive, one thing I found lacking in all of these accounts is specific details on how much all of this costs to make the transition, buy land, buy buildings. You said you planted several thousand oak trees. This must have cost a lot of money. How much did it cost? In dollars and cents, and also how you sustained yourself before this farm got up and working. That's what always enters in the back of our mind.
Okay, Chris, okay. Well, I can answer one of the questions. You sustained yourself by being a professor and head of a department. But go ahead, I'll let you take over from there.
That's absolutely true. Yes, I worked hard and had a very successful and delightful career, and that was a source of income. But with regard to the oak trees, interestingly enough, the total cost for that is zero. I know where are located about 50 to 100 beautiful white oaks and chestnut oaks in my area in Maine and in Western Mass. And whenever I'm on a trip in the fall, I simply gather, let's say between 2 and 3,000 acorns, and I bring them back and I store them in my root cellar under soil. And I plant 100 to 150 of those in November, and those are all sprouted up right now. I've got them out on my porch, and I'll put those out as soon as the other vegetation leaves out. And I'm able, in fact, to give acorns to a couple of my friends. I have a friend across the valley who is working on to improve habitat and doing a great job of it. She was just over the other day, and we gave her about 100 acorns, all sprouted, ready to go. And a neighbor down the street, down the road, right at the beginning of my road, my good friend Bob, I gave him a few, and he called me the other day and he said he had planted them as well. So we do things in the most economical way that you can possibly imagine. Both Lee and I are hideously frugal people, and so we regularly, in spite of the fact that we have the resources to do them otherwise, we don't. And so we get great joy out of this. In fact, regularly, I'll say, I'm thinking of this. And Lee will say, couldn't we do this way? Wouldn't this be a good substitute for that? And often it's a substitute that doesn't cost much at all. But the basic operation, you are right. Purchasing a farm is not inexpensive. Getting it up and going is not inexpensive. Buying the equipment that you need, tractor, chainsaw, pole saw, weed whacker, these things are not inexpensive. So it's not the sort of thing that that I could have undertaken had I not put in those long years of work and saved my money assiduously.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. We do have to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do D.R. Struck Landscape Nursery on Route 202 in Winthrop, offering a selection of plants and flowers for Mother's Day. And the Davis Family Foundation, proud to support Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical through the Charting a Bold Future campaign.
On the next Fresh Air, Gabourey Sidibe. She made her acting debut in Lee Daniels' 2009 film Precious, a role that got her an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. Since then, she's been in Empire, The Big C, and American Horror Story. Sidibe has a new memoir called This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, Speaking in Maine takes us next to Northport and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations for a talk entitled U.S. Nuclear Forces, Decisions for the Trump Administration. The speaker is John Harvey, a physicist with over 35 years of experience working with nuclear weapons and national security issues, including in the Departments of Defense and Energy. That's Speaking in Maine, coming up at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how one professor has embraced life on a remote farm and how he does it. Joining me today, John Toomey. He's a retired professor from the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and has written a book about retiring to a remote farm in Maine and living simply and in touch with nature. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Professor Toomey, I suspect there are many people listening right now who maybe aren't prepared either financially or emotionally to do what you've done and live on a remote farm, but maybe would like to live a little closer, a little more in harmony with nature, maybe create some wildlife habitat on their property. What kind of small tips can you give us all to just improve our everyday quality of life since we're lucky enough to live in Maine?
Well, the good thing about wildlife habitat is no matter what you do, you'll find something, some wild creature responds to it. So if someone likes a flower garden, is a great place for native pollinators. Something as simple as instead of hauling the brush that you trim off of trees in the yard, pile that up in one area. Something will take advantage of that. If you have a little bit more land and you might find on it oak trees or apple trees, you could cut away some of the trees that compete with those so that they're more productive, giving them a little more light. They'll produce more acorns and more apples. So there are a number of small things like that that you can do regardless of the amount of space that you have. If you have a small pond, or you could put in a small pond, that's terrifically helpful to all of our amphibian friends, all the lovely frogs and salamanders that we have here in Maine.
We'll go to Eleanor calling from Camden. Eleanor, we tried to go to you before, I think, when we were having some problems. Are you there now?
Yes, I am. Oh. That's okay. Thanks for taking me now.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mostly express my gratitude for your efforts in writing this book. I'm 21 years old. I'm in college. And I actually just returned home to the Mid-Coast a few days ago from Beijing, China, where I spent a semester abroad. I've never lived in a big city before, and that was definitely the biggest city that one could possibly go to. So I definitely have a new appreciation for Maine and the lifestyle that is here. And unfortunately, I came home, or fortunately, I came home to my parents getting ready to retire and move to Florida. So we've just packed up our house. So I just wanted to say I'm really appreciative of your efforts in writing this book so that I can continue to experience Maine in this way. And I think that I hope someday when I retire, if I have the financial means, to be able to do something similar to what you're doing. And my quick question is just in terms of your partner and making this big decision, because it seems to be a real lifestyle change for both of you, how did you come to an agreement on this? Was she on board as well from the get-go, or how did that work?
Good question, Eleanor.
Yeah, that is a good question. And yes, indeed, it's a very important consideration. I'm happy to say that Lee is more dedicated, more interested, more if possible, more dedicated and interested in this lifestyle than am I. She had a quiet childhood and a fairly rural setting, and just by nature, her nature, in addition to those early experiences, prepared her for loving a lifestyle like this, the quiet, the peaceful. We're both rather introverted people. We like it nice and quiet. We both love nature. We take walks and we come back and tell each other what we've seen, or we have walkie-talkies, and if we happen upon a particularly interesting bird or sight, we'll call back to the house or to wherever the other person is and report and share those things. And it's just, thank goodness, she loves the growing of the vegetable gardens, the grafting of apple trees, the harvesting of fruit, the putting up of fruit. And she's an incredible baker and in every regard has great ability with a wood stove and so on and so forth. So there's great harmony there, and we all know that that matters a huge amount. Thank you very much.
Eleanor, thanks for your call. We have an email from Carolyn. How do you deal with deer eating in the garden?
Very good question, yes. Deer, first of all, I mentioned the habitat areas on the fields. One of those habitat areas is the creation of 12 salad areas. Those are areas about 100 yards long by about 50 yards wide that I mow numerous times during the summer so that there are, and I've planted in those areas ladino clover, alsite clover, and purple top clover, along with all of the native plants, dandelions, and so on. These produce fresh greens all summer, and they're all located in a fairly quiet, isolated spot. So deer like to feed where they feel secure. They're right next to the woods, so they often go to those areas because of the nutritious, fresh greens that are coming up. Now, within the garden per se, we have a fence around the things that the deer like most, the carrots, the beets, the broccoli, the cauliflower, the Napa cabbage. All of those things are included in a fenced-in area. And outside of that, we plant the things that they like less or don't like at all. Those would include the onions, the garlic, potatoes, tomatoes, rhubarb. And so by working, by being aware of what they like and what they don't like, it tends to have them go elsewhere. Now, on occasion, we also plant butternut squash outside of those areas. Now, on occasion, we will find that a deer nips off a piece of a leaf on a butternut or on a bean, which they also do like. We watch our garden very carefully. Key to gardening effectively is observing regularly and being persistent and being patient. So we observe our garden every day. If we see one little bite off of a butternut leaf, we immediately bring out a 25 or 30 foot long, 8 foot wide piece of 2-inch mesh chicken wire and lay it over that whole area. Now, deer don't like to step on wire, and they don't like to put their muzzles against the wire. So within a day or so, they give that up, and we never let them get going on it to really get in love with and comfortable with that particular area. So we bring that wire out immediately, and that might happen one or two times a summer at most.
We'll go to David, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. I heard you mention native pollinators, and I was wondering if you had ever considered raising bees or you didn't want to compete with the native pollinators.
Good question. I did give some consideration to raising bees some time ago. However, I found that there are a lot of issues with raising bees. It's difficult to keep the Verona mites off of them and various other problems that have ensued of late with honeybees. So I've decided that I would not have them. We don't use much sweets, to be honest with you, and so we didn't need the honey. Beyond that, the native pollinators have always been there, and they're well adapted to pollinating blueberries and apples, which pears, peaches, which are our major crops. Beyond that, the native pollinators, we live in a cool area here in Maine, and the native pollinators are very comfortable working below 55 degrees, which is a temperature below which European honeybees, which are an import, do not like to work. Also, the native pollinators work when it is drizzly out or raining just a little, and the European honeybees also don't favor those conditions. Beyond that, The bumblebees and the blue orchard bees and the mason bees are 10 times more efficient at pollinating than are the European honeybees. So it takes only 10 blue orchard bees to pollinate as much blueberries or apples as it would take 100 honeybees. So as a result of that, our conclusion is let's go with the native guys and support them. So we do that by all of these mowing patterns, which favor the local flowers, particularly in the fall and spring. We spread the seed. We have spread for years the seed of the dandelion and the sow thistle, which blossoms in the fall, and that's when they need the most help, the native pollinators, in the spring, early spring and in the fall. And then beyond that, the girdling of trees and letting borers get in there and making holes through those trees creates habitat for the mason bees to lay their eggs in and raise their young in. Also, we have several miles of stone walls, and the bumblebees like to go into those. We keep those open so that there are plenty of crevices for the bumblebees to get into and raise their young. So we have an abundance of wild bees. We love the wild bees, and we really don't feel any need for the wonderful for honeybees at this point.
David, thanks for your call. We'll go to Cornish and Josh. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to ask, I'm super impressed by what you got going on here. Like, I actually wish I could get involved in doing this. But I was kind of wondering something, because taking on something this big and kind of, you know, it's different than, like, the way of life that everybody normally does. What do you do about, like, I guess what I was thinking, health insurance or something? Like, God forbid something happens or whatnot. Like, what happens there, I guess?
God forbid something happens. But, yeah, that's a good question. Well, as I mentioned early on, I had the 37-year career at the University of Massachusetts, and part of my retirement from there was a continuation of health insurance. Now, I do, of course, pay a significant part for that, but that's a situation. The health insurance that I had as a professor carries right on now. In fact, I don't have Medicare or Medicaid, simply the health insurance that I had early on, which is a very decent policy from the company Harvard Health. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Josh, for your call. Larkspur on Facebook posts, great to hear John on the radio. The way he and Lee live and work are an inspiration. They live in such an interconnected manner and are so enthusiastic about nature and living in nature. I'm lucky enough to be a friend and neighbor and simply want to recommend his book for anyone living close to the earth. Even if one is already engaged in living sustainably and close to the land, there is something to inspire you in there. Professor Toomey, where can one find your book?
Well, probably the easiest way is just to go to John, johnhtwomey.com. And right there is my website, and it can be ordered right off the website. A number of bookstores in Maine also have it, I know. But the simplest way probably is just to go right online, stay right at home, and the publisher will ship it right directly to your home.
Great. We're going to see if we can squeeze in a couple more questions. Scott in Winthrop. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Scott.
Curious.
That was my problem. Go ahead.
Sure. I come from a section of Massachusetts, probably north of where the professor grew up, not quite as far west. And an observation that I have living in Maine now is that a lot of the species, and one must assume that it's from climate change, are changing. One example was we never had to worry about ticks on the dog unless it was a particularly mild winter, even as far south as that. And additionally, it was always a great event where we lived to see bird species like cardinals, which now, in both cases, I have to check my dog very carefully, and I see cardinals pretty regularly, both in Winthrop and up at a home we have at Sugarloaf. So I was curious if you see the same kind of observations and what other types of species, if any, you have observed.
Well, yes, I have seen, indeed, of course, where I grew up in Western Mass, we never had ticks as when I was a kid. Probably my life would be entirely different had there been a lot around. My mother might not have let me roam day in and day out through the woods there. But yes, and there were no ticks in our area of Maine up until 5 or 6 years ago. now we are very careful to wear light-colored pants and light-colored socks and tuck our pants into our socks and so on, do tick checks every day. And indeed, so that is an issue, no question about it. And I assume it is global warming. I'm not sure what else it could be. The cardinals also, there were none around in Western Mass when I was a boy. They're here now. In addition, mockingbirds, we see those, and we never saw those when I was a kid in Western Mass. They're there, and they're here now as well. I love their song. The tufted titmouse also we never saw. And we had, for the first time last year, three of those at the farm who are regular visits. So we walk and we ski in the winter and always carry sunflower seeds with us. And Lee works very assiduously to train the little birds up to eat out of our hands. So when we're skiing along, a flock of chickadees will stop and land on our hands and eat sunflower seeds right from us. And we have a couple of pairs of rose-breasted nuthatches that do that as well. And last winter, they were all joined by three tufted titmice. So, yes, I am seeing that as well. And I can only assume it is attributable to, as you said, global warming.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for your call. And that is going to be the last call. I want to ask you before we let you go, Professor Toomey, what are you excited about this year? What's going on right now? Are you going to get to harvest your asparagus finally?
Yes, indeed. This is the fourth year on the asparagus, and it'll be the first year that we actually do harvest some. So we're waiting for it to come up. Last year, it came up on May 23rd, the same day that the milkweed came up on the bank of the lower and upper pond, which we also eat the milkweed quite a lot when the small shoots, when they're under 8 inches, they're great in an omelet or in a stir fry or in a stew. But the asparagus we're really, really looking forward to, and I've promised Lee I'll make some omelets that include asparagus. That and there are all sorts of other things as well. We're waiting to see. We did 45 or 46 heirloom apple grafts in the last 2 weeks. So every day we're going out and looking at the buds on those and saying, have you noticed any change? Have you noticed any development? And I think I am noticing it on three or four. Last year we had good success, and I'm hoping we will again this year.
Well, thank you so much. John Toomey worked 37 years at UMass Dartmouth, where he was chair of the Department of Foreign Literature and Languages. He now lives on his farm in Montville, and his new book about his experiences is called Retiring To, Not From, Intimate Details of Life on a Remote Farm in Maine. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Sam Dearen answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation with NPR journalist Tom Gelton. His current beat is religion, faith, and belief, but previously he covered national and international news. We will discuss his most recent book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Public Radio.